It is Saturday, July 14th, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, our Week in Geek news segment, and in the second half, your questions and comments of technology.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we're covering the Week in Geek News, and during the second half of the show, I will welcome you to join our conversation. You can ask us anything you'd like today. The numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or go online right now and go to geekspeak.org to send us a message. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. Why does a painter choose a specific color, or a dancer a certain movement, or a musician one chord and not another? We wonder about these things just like you do. Our reporters, producers, and editors bring you stories every day that increase your understanding of art and the natural world. News you can use. Weekday mornings from 5 to 9 a.m. on Morning Edition from NPR News. Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Cruise.io, providing local internet services including DSL, computer care, classes, and website builders. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air and with me are geeks. Ryder Brooks, support engineer at Sun Microsystems. Congratulations on your new job, Ryder.
Oh, thank you very much.
And Miles Elam, formerly a Slacker geek, but right now quite busy doing technical contract work, writing. Are you enjoying writing, Miles?
It pays the bills.
So you're doing like an 8-hour day, and then you go to school for 4 hours.
2 hours.
You sleep at all?
Yeah.
Yeah, but not a haircut.
Don't have time for a haircut.
Totally understand. Before we get into taking people's calls in about 20 minutes or so, let's go ahead and do some geek news. Miles, I'd like to start with you.
There's a woman in central Sweden, a town called Karlstad, a 75-year-old woman, who now has the title of the fastest internet connection going to a residence. The speed is 40 gigabits per second. Now, to put that into context, the fastest DSL and cable that we can get these days is between 6 and 8 megabits per second. So
almost 100 times slower.
Right. Now, yes.
Well, I have to do the math on that. Let's see. We won't do that. But okay, so
I'm sorry. Wait, no.
40 gigabits.
No, it's more than 1,000 times.
More than 1,000
times. That's almost 10,000 times faster.
Yeah. Okay, so 40 gigabytes. I mean,
gigabits.
Gigabits. Okay, gigabits. All right, so
so 5 gigabytes.
But you could still do a DVD in like a second and a half. A second.
On the contrary, you can send a whole high definition DVD in 2 seconds. So a DVD would be less than half a second.
That's as fast as hard drive speed, isn't it?
Oh, that's much faster than hard drive speed.
How could she use... Who is this woman?
This woman
isn't the queen or anything,
is the mother of a Swedish internet guru named Peter Lothberg.
So his mom has the best internet connection.
Right. Well, what he's doing is he's trying to encourage people to, one, to hire him and to get him to install this equipment, but also trying to get the internet providers in his country of Sweden to invest in faster speeds. And I'm sure he's trying to do it for surrounding countries as well, in that she is connected through a fiber channel. Or a fiber optic connection. Channel.
Is she connected directly to the internet? I mean,
effectively, because
there's a bottleneck somewhere.
One of the things about the about fiber optics is that you don't really have resistance per se over time, and so the links for the technology that she has allow up to 2,000 kilometers.
Wow.
In between segments. So what we're talking about is that whole issue of the last mile. This is a major issue with regard to internet connections, in that you can have major trunk connections between, say, the East Coast and the West Coast.
Or between cities, even.
Yeah. Right. But that last mile, in other words, from the typically the phone company's
head office transfer station, or something.
Yeah, yeah. Or central office, to the actual home, that's where you have the DSL speeds, the cable speeds, where everything gets much slower.
Right, at the ISPs, or at the business offices that serve phones, you've got really great high-speed access.
Right.
So that last mile issue, is this internet guru guy planning on doing this kind of execution of fiber right to people's homes?
Well, that's the idea. He's trying to see the market, trying to get people
interested
in it. The fact that they can do this, because laying fiber is not that expensive, right. At least the hardware in and of itself.
Well, the fiber line itself, it's actually the expensive part is the switches and
yeah, and it's more expensive than say copper, but it's still, especially with the fact that with copper traditional lines or coax, you have to have a transfer point. You have to have the equivalent of a switch on a regular basis,
right? To rally the signal,
right?
If you will.
At least every few miles.
Okay, so he's using pretty high end.
Well, obviously, if he's getting
2,000 kilometers,
40 gigabits.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
But at the same time, if you have 1 kilometer versus 20 kilometers, you're still having effectively the same speed. You don't have that slowdown that you have with the resistance in copper lines or.
But what happens when you start talking about running fiber? And by the way, fiber is really inexpensive, I believe. I mean, the expense of making, I guess it's still glass. So.
But it's maintenance
that costs the money.
What's that?
Maintenance, yeah. And splicing it and issues like that. I believe that's where the expense comes in with fiber optic.
You also have a situation where if you're running a fiber line, like, that is overkill. Isn't 40 gigabits per second overkill for a home? I mean, how would you ever use that? You'd have to have a whole bunch of computers in there to even.
But that's also, these are technical limitations of it. You don't necessarily have to have it. Like, upstream, there may
not be. But what happens normally
is
people go, let's do fiber, and then that fiber channel can be shared by a lot of people, and then you have to put in some kind of distro.
Well,
and
it's not like cable where you have the same trunk everyone
shares the same trunk.
With fiber, chances are it would be like phone lines where you do have
individual
a line.
Yeah.
But you're right, people could share a single line, have it come out to a certain point, and
then you get a situation where you got to have it to switch, you got to have a place with power, and then you're doing another type of technology most likely to the different people.
But you're also getting rid of issues like resistance on the line.
Do you think
to worry about interference.
Do you think this last mile, I mean, just from your guys' perspective, do you think that the last mile is going to be a cabling solution of some kind of physical thing that connects two points, or do you think it's going to start slowly moving to wireless?
It depends on how things go. Right now, there's a big fight between AT&T and Google over wireless spectrum.
Uh-huh. And the 700 megahertz range.
Right.
Oh, this whole thing that's opening up. Right.
And Google trying to get them to send it off on auction, have a lower barrier to entry. And there are many saying that Google just wants to lower the prices so they can buy up more. But at the same time, I don't know what Google. I mean, Google is a corporation. They may or may not do things that are good for us. But I'm pretty sure that AT&T does not have our best interests in mind.
Yeah, but you don't know necessarily the corporation.
Well, I mean, what it comes down to is a few years ago, I was so angry with AT&T that I switched over to a cable modem, and I made sure that I did not have a phone.
Is this because you didn't pay your phone bill and they turned you off and then wouldn't activate you for a couple of weeks?
No, there were things that were going on besides that. But yes, that was a factor. Right. I mean, I'm not.
You didn't like the customer service solution in this. In any case,
it was more the spying aspect. They colluded with the NSA with regard to wiretapping. That was what really broke the camel's back.
So you went over to cable.
And so now I'm, you know, working with cable, but still there's when I went started living more, spending more time with my girlfriend, it's like cable. Well, that's really expensive. Before I had this cable line in my house, but then I quit my job. And what's the cheapest option you can get? Well, you have to get DSL.
Right.
And no matter what provider you get, like for example, I could get a line through Cruise IO. I'm still paying AT&T money
eventually
for the line
in this area. Sure. Now, okay. What about? I mean, one of the other solutions besides like the wireless. And I would include wireless with satellite, even though there's other issues when you're doing wireless satellite. And then telephone lines, cable lines, or fiber optic, new types of cabling. What about the current cabling that powers our homes? Is there any more advances in that? You've brought it up before. I know we're
kind of cabling that the powers our home. Power lines?
Power lines.
Oh, internet over power lines, yeah.
Is anybody doing that still?
Internet over power lines. Yeah. Oh, okay, sorry. I was just talking about like power. What do you mean power in general? That one had issues with regard to ham radio operators because there was interference on the line on their frequency.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I know that in the past they had worked out some of the interference issues.
Right.
I know that there are a lot of ham operators who still weren't happy about the state of things. But probably a bigger barrier to entry is the fact that you have a lot of companies that provide internet service, be they cable companies like Comcast or DSL providers like Verizon or AT&T, that were blocking access from a legislative standpoint, not from a technical standpoint.
Right, right.
Because
course.
they don't want
the competition.
One, they don't want the competition, but their argument is they don't want the government competing with them. So, so they have pushed for legislation blocking their entry.
Well, this is enough about cabling and network speeds and all that. Let's do the next news story, Mr. Brooks.
Well, not quite fully away from it. I want to segue on it. Verizon's actually announced that they're going to be getting out of their copper business for their infrastructure and going more exclusively with fiber optic cables.
Does Verizon support people's in residence?
I believe they do,
in some areas?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Basically, I think what's going on is their copper network is basically collapsing because of scavenging. The high cost of copper has led people to basically scavenge copper from, you know, cabling that's around. And basically the cables that Verizon and other providers use are the big beefy things. And
right.
You just cut a segment out and you get...
People actually doing this?
Yes. Actually... My wife used to work for a company that was based out of the local sash mill tannery,
uh-huh.
And they had this old building there, and they were frequently catching people in there scavenging and stealing cabling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and mostly it was copper that they were after.
Interesting.
So I have no idea who they're selling it to.
So Verizon's planning on getting rid of all their copper lines and putting in new fiber.
Yeah, I think they're just switching away from that infrastructure and investing.
I wonder if they'll take fiber to the end home.
Well, they probably will.
Yeah.
But there is one wrinkle in all of this. Even after I've extolled the virtues of fiber, right now over copper lines with DSL, those phone providers, or typically phone providers, are mandated to open their lines up to competition.
Right.
Which is how providers like Cruise.io can offer DSL.
Right. Even though they're the end user, the whole long distance mandate of anybody can sell long distance to your customers and internet service as well, it's one of the things that's being forced on these local phone owners.
The same requirements do not apply to fiber.
Oh, that's not good. So they'll serve fiber to your home, but then it's like a cable company owning it.
Exactly.
And anything
they lay the fiber and say, that's it. That's, we own it. No one else.
So, to some degree, that would destroy the small mom and pop ISPs.
Well, it would also.
Or even the relatively large ISPs.
And it may quite possibly raise prices because there wouldn't be any competition in the space.
Well, would you guys pay for more bandwidth would you pay more money for higher bandwidth, 40 gigabits per second?
Absolutely. But how much more is the question. It's not a question of how much bandwidth you're willing to pay for. It's how much can you afford versus your return on it.
Yeah. All right. So now, thank you very much, Ryder, for that. Sorry. Can we go on to other news?
Sure. We could segue into something else.
All right. Well, my name's Lyle Troxley. Listen to Miles Elam and Ryder Brooks. We'll be taking your calls in about 10 more minutes. We're doing some geek news of the week. What else is happening?
I got a different one. Okay. So researchers have developed what they call a regret-free tattoo. Your conventional tattoos are pretty permanent unless you get some extensive laser surgery and there might be scarring involved. And
Ryder, do you have any tattoos?
I do not have any tattoos.
Miles?
Neither do I.
No.
Okay. No. I don't have any that we want to talk about on the air. So, go on.
So they've developed a new tattoo that basically has ink particles that are suspended in a biodegradable polymer coating. Basically, think like of a... like inkjets have like the little bubbles.
Yeah.
Basically, when they hit the surface, they pop and that forms your ink on that. So they're basically kind of like that, where they're little bubbles, and they use that as the ink base. And they're pretty durable. They're not your they use that as the ink. Goes in, do your pretty little drawings, whatever you want. And if you decide down the road that this is not something that you want, a simple one-pass laser process will heat up that polymer and it will burst the ink, and your body basically just absorbs it and it disappears.
Or the shell would burst and then the ink would.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So, do you know if it's like little shelling stuff stays under your skin, or does the laser just kind of melt it completely and then your body can eat it?
Yeah, it's
up?
Biodegradable. So, wow. I mean, once it, you
once
know.
It's been.
I don't know.
What do you guys think?
I don't have any tattoos, but it seems to diminish
the coolness of it?
Well, no. One of the things about a tattoo is its permanence.
Yeah, that's the reason I don't have any. I mean, because I know that at one point I'm going to be 70, I'm going to be like, wow, I wish I didn't have this tattoo that said Geek Speak on it.
But you're right. It does allow for you to back out. But what about the whole concept of that commitment of I'm getting a tattoo and this is something that
I guess we should talk to people that are tattooed about this.
Yeah,
we're not
talk
right
to somebody that's decided to in their youth tattoo their entire face. You know, yeah. I think they regret that later.
Yeah, Lex, if you're listening, give me a call. Let me know what you thought of this.
Okay, so this would make it relatively, and I guess it would take a few weeks after you did this for your body to take up the inks.
Did not state how long it would take, but I think it was relatively quickly.
Wouldn't it be horrible if it was like you burst it, it gets all blurry, and then it just stays permanent?
And another one that I heard about a while ago was, I think it was ultraviolet ink.
Uh-huh.
That basically when you would tattoo it, you would only see like maybe a faint picture of what it was due to the scarring or the irritation to the skin. But you would only see that tattoo if you put like a black light over it.
Now that was cool. Yeah. That's something I would seriously
would you
at.
Do your face with that?
No.
Well, didn't we talk about a while ago someone finding LCDs, LCD tattooing? People were doing research on this. Remember this? You're injecting small LCD chips as the ink. It goes under the skin. And they're all networked together, so you could actually program and have a display that would change.
Oh, that would be
about
cool.
This?
No, I haven't.
Oh, we covered it like 3 years ago on Geek Speak. Of course, nothing's happened of it. It's probably it was probably an April Fool's joke we never even knew about. All right, Miles, next news story, sir.
A researcher at Cambridge University, a PhD candidate by the name of Rufus Pollock, has used economic formulas to answer an age-old question. How long should copyright be? In recent years, or in the past, 50, 60 years, copyright has been extended dramatically from when it was originally codified in the original, Statute of Anne. And
the basic concept of copyright is you're creative. We want to create creativity. So we'll make rules that give you a limited ownership of that content that you create.
Right, a limited monopoly, yeah.
Limited monopoly, therefore you can make money on it, and then people are incited by the government, if you will, to make creative work.
Right. Or rather, a limited monopoly, limited in time, but not in scope.
Right.
And at the formation of this country, copyright was, I believe, 27 years.
The basic concept, the idea was that it was going to be your lifetime. That in your you made your content, it would be about your lifetime or a long period of your life.
I don't know that it was a lifetime because people still lived.
Yeah,
I mean,
still,
the average age made it.
You know, if you're 40 and you do some new work, I mean, there's 27 years is a long time.
The part that I always refer back to in the Constitution was limited times to promote the progress of arts and sciences. It was not a marketing term. It wasn't so you could. It wasn't written in such a way that you were led to believe it was to maximize profit. It was. To
maximize public good.
Right, to give profit as an incentive so that people would continue to create things.
Right. And copyright, I mean, before U.S. government formed, copyright rules and regulations and everything, it's a very common, copyright and trademark is a very common governmental issue. Because lots of governments have dealt with it. So,
and nowadays, nowadays it's, 70 to 90 years after.
Well, it's as long as Mickey Mouse. Right. That's kind of the joke about it, is that Disney Corporation does not want to lose the copyright on Mickey Mouse. And so every time that's going to expire, then the range is updated.
Well, it's a little different because you also – now it's after a certain number of years after the creator's death or if it's a work for hire, you have a certain – so, I mean, it goes out to somewhere between 90 and 110 years.
That's a long time.
Yeah. Longer than the average human lifetime.
This basically means that any content that your children are exposed to right now – it will never expire in their lifetime, which means they'll never be able to reuse that work without threat of litigation.
In theory, Mickey Mouse would, or Steamboat Willie, the early
they would,
of it,
but
assuming that it was not retroactively extended again,
right?
By Congress,
but like the Pixar films,
years.
You know, all of us know Monsters Inc. If you got kids, that's one of those films,
right.
that
would not
in
be
our lifetime we'll never see the little green.
In our lifetime, no one would ever be able to make parodies of it that were not
without. Well, they can do parodies. There's some things that are lightened, but
well, yeah.
In general, you wouldn't be able to reuse that work or make a derivative work off of it,
right? The Further Adventures
without
of the Incredibles without...
Right. Okay, so...
So this person used standard economics formulas to try to find, according to math, what is the optimal level for copyright.
And is it optimal for profit or for general economic health?
It was a measure of economic health and also the production of that material. How do you get it so that more of it is created?
Created, uh-huh. What's the magic number?
14 years.
14 years?
14 years, yeah.
That seems pretty reasonable. I like that idea. So that means that after something was...
He was citing things like the lower barrier to entry for reproduction and production with the digital tools that are out there to create the work is much less effort. To distribute the work with the internet is much lower to get out to a wider audience. It's basically instantaneous and
well, you know,
close
also,
to free.
If you think about... Any major motion pictures even right now, the money they make is in the first 5 to 10 years. After that, it's people's interest in it has waned, and though DVDs might still be sold and they still might put it on television with commercial advertising and make some revenue on it, you're in 5, 10 years, that's pretty
long. I'm glad that you brought up DVDs because there's been that people talking about DVD rot. We've had a story
sure.
about it before. DVDs, some of them degrading long before they were supposed to. Now, let's say you have
probably
a movie that isn't
but.
That is a favorite, mm-hmm. favorite movie of yours, but is not a favorite of
the population,
world,
sure.
right? And you have a DVD. That DVD may destroy itself before the copyright is up. In other words, it would
before
not
90
be
years.
Yeah, it may not be legal for you to create it and preserve it, or to copy it and preserve it before it is no longer available. And that's one of the worries that many people have: is you have all these copywritten works that. Before they can fall out of copyright into the public domain, that their originals may be lost.
The original copyright, of course, is books and copying books. And if you have a book, even 90 years, it's fine. At the end of 90 years, you can still pick that book off the shelf and reproduce it if you want.
Assuming it's on acid-free paper.
True. But with DVDs, we might not have that option. So
with a lot of the media, considering a lot of our stuff is electronic, and we were talking about this briefly during our Blu-ray
yeah.
show.
Another good example would be television shows. Like, if a television show comes out, Firefly was an example, that gets canceled after a period of time. Theoretically, there's nobody that wants to watch it because it's not profitable for them to make it. They don't make it anymore. And so some DVDs released, but then nothing's ever done about it. After 50 years, that could be completely gone. You know, the company that owned that, files get lost. I mean, we're talking about creative work possibly disappearing forever.
Right. Although, I do have to mention that right now, so many people have copies of these movies on their hard drive. Either from file sharing and the like. And so chances are these things won't go away, but the reason they don't go away is because people are breaking the law.
Right.
It's a curious thing. The reason why they will be preserved is because people are participating in peer-to-peer sharing.
All right, so this guy is saying that copyright should be limited to 14 years. Miles, do you think the United States government is going to push to that idea? I think what we have...
Well, no. I mean, when they've been retroactively extending the length of copyright, the idea of retroactively extending seems odd for the creation of new works because the stuff's already been created. You don't need an incentive to have it created. So why would you need to retroactively extend it?
Interesting. Thanks, Miles, for that news story. Ryder, thank you very much for your news story. Well,
sure.
Maybe we'll do a little bit more news in just a few minutes, but I want to invite you right now to call us up. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll give it those phone numbers again if you want. Just keep your pencils on. Or you can go to geekspeak.org. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, Notary Public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak. We are now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. Toll free at 1-800-655-KUSP. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the internet. Go to geekspeak.org and just click on Contact Us.
Stay with KOSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Ryder Brooks and Miles Elam. And we are taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. You can ask us anything you'd like. You got a broken hard drive, you're having trouble reinstalling Windows. We all have Macintoshes in front of us. We can probably help you with Mac questions too. And we got someone who works for SCO, so probably Unix and Linux questions would be fine as well. I'm sorry, not SCO. Sun. So Java questions would be good. No, I don't know what's Sun most famous for. I guess Java.
NFS.
And NFS and like
popularization of Unix and yeah.
And microsystems in general, right? GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. All right. Call us up. I cover everything, right? Call us up. We know what we're talking about, kind of. And we'll make it up if we don't. Rick's standing by on the phones. Oh, yeah, phone numbers, 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. Toll-free at 1-800-655 KUSP. Ryder, I'll go to the next news story to you, sir.
Got a quickie one. So astronomers are asking the internet community to help them out with some of their research. There's a project called Galaxy Zoo, and it's basically astronomers have amassed millions of images of snapshots of galaxies that have never been seen before by most people. And they're asking people to do a quick visual examination and help them classify the galaxies. Since it's a lot easier and quicker for the human eye to identify images than it is a computer to recognize it. So they're asking people to, in exchange for getting to see some pretty cool pictures, to classify galaxies as being elliptical, which is kind of like ball-shaped galaxies, or if they're, whirlpool-type galaxies, which they call spirals.
Like ours.
Yeah. And basically, if they're spiral, do they go counterclockwise or clockwise? And basically, it helps them amass a bunch of data to help them kind of reevaluate how the galaxy or the universe is basically formed and the structure of it.
Cool.
And so you just go to galaxyzoo.org and you log in and you can just check out some really cool photographs. And I think it's pretty cool. And it sort of just illustrates, the inefficiency of the power of the computer sometimes to do things. I think we talked about this offline in the past where you have the, some of the security prevention things where you have a little kind of distorted picture with words and letters that you're asked to, type in what that looks like. For it's an authentication sequence.
Yeah, they're called captchas. Captchas.
Captchas.
Captchas. So it's kind of like in that similarity to that, how the human brain is more capable of processing information.
Sure.
And it's something of personal intrigue to me.
Have you done any of these photos?
A couple of them, just to check it out.
And are they pretty cool photos?
Yeah. They're not super high resolution, but
is it neat looking at things that are over a billion years old? Do you enjoy that?
I do. Yeah.
Old light.
So we get to name them, so I can be like,
oh, Miles. Can you name them? Like, name them then?
No.
Oh, man.
Like Miles Galaxy, the second Miles Galaxy.
They have cryptic little names already, cat classification names.
Right. They, basically, they're named after the exact
quadrant
location where they are.
Exactly, yeah. Very, very romantic.
7744771.
It's kind of cool to just, just the vast number of galaxies out there, just millions of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been listening to this great podcast from Stanford about cosmology. I think the class is something like physics that a president would need to know. So the general concept is this is science that every president should know. Kind of a cool idea, though. And I've been listening to all the lectures are online. I'll have to put it on the website. In any case, on geekspeak.org. In any case, one of the things they're talking about cosmology is talking about stars and the creation of the universe and the idea that all the stars that you see are all in the Milky Way. So these are all neighboring stars, all of them with the naked eye. There's a few objects you can see that are not. They're actually distant galaxies, but they're more a little blurrier, and they're not actually stars. And then, of course, there's the planets in our solar system we can see that look like stars sometimes but aren't. In any case, in the space where you can't see stars, if you will, if you look at some stars and you see like a black spot, if you were to magnify that a whole bunch, you would see a whole bunch of galaxies. In fact, the entire sky would be covered in galaxies. There's never, you look any direction and eventually you'll run into a galaxy. Pretty phenomenal. That's a lot of galaxies. There's a lot more galaxies than there are stars in the Milky Way. So, galaxy. So that's pretty cool. Okay, so we're doing calls and questions and comments of technology. We have a couple people on the line, so let's go ahead and take Let's go ahead and take Dave from Santa Cruz. Dave, welcome to Geek Speak.
Yeah.
Hi. What's your question, Dave?
I'm trying to get Wi-Fi to my house the cheapest way possible. Just got a computer. And T-Mobile had an ad, something about linking your – I'm with Singular or AT&T, and from what I understand, I don't have cable for my TV. Mm-hmm. I don't have – in other words, I have at this point, I have no hookup. They said something about you can run your home phone. Is T-Mobile worth switching to for a Wi-Fi connection? That's what I'm asking.
In Santa Cruz?
T-Mobile doing Wi-Fi?
Yeah, it's not really Wi-Fi. It's on their cell networks.
Right. But isn't that pretty slow speed? I mean, we're talking pretty...
It's actually not... It's not as fast as a terrestrial network.
Do you use T-Mobile as your cell phone carrier?
No, right now I'm with AT&T. Well, Singular. Uh-huh. I started with Singular. They're supposed to be the new AT&T.
Right, but you're in Santa Cruz?
Yeah. And mm-hmm. there was going to be free Wi-Fi. I was holding out, getting the computer, thinking it might come in.
Where are you in Santa Cruz? Downtown?
West Side.
West Side. I think the free Wi-Fi, I don't know how far it's going to go to the West Side.
Yeah, and T-Mobile, I haven't heard good things about it in Santa
Cruz. I think when it comes down to getting good high-speed access, you really want to go with cable or with DSL. Mm-hmm. There are some spots that providers are actually servicing the home with Wi-Fi, and this is mostly small remote communities. So communities that are in a valley might get hit from the top of the hill with a Wi-Fi, and that's a great way to cover that area because it's so far away from any of the phone systems. You can't really run DSL there. But in metropolitan areas, like even on the west side of Santa Cruz, there's so much DSL, there's so much phone access, you can get really good DSL and good cable that an ISP is not going to want to spend the extra dough to do a blanket Wi-Fi in that area.
Does Comcast do that?
Comcast does it through cable if you want to buy cable television. It's pretty expensive. And then, especially if you don't watch TV.
You don't need to get cable TV.
Oh, really? Well, how much is it then?
It's still pretty pricey.
Like $50.
More expensive than DSL. Less expensive and then gets progressively more
expensive. What's my cheapest option?
DSL is your cheapest option.
You're looking at like $16
a month.
Yeah, 15.
I mean, assuming you have a phone line.
But this is assuming you have a phone line.
There was a recent settlement. If you are a new customer that does not already have phone and DSL.
Well, I use the mobile phone for my home phone.
Okay, well,
if you don't already have DSL, you can get the basic level DSL. It's slower, but for something like $10 a month.
Yeah, but is that on top of a phone line? You have the phone number too, right? And a phone number costs $23 a month.
No, it doesn't. Not if you don't get any long distance.
Okay, so what you'd want to do, the cheapest option for you is to go to what is it? Who's the phone carrier here? SBC?
No, it's AT&T.
So you go to AT&T and you say, I want phone service. I want the cheapest phone number possible. I want no added whistles, no voicemail, nothing like that. And I don't want any long distance access at all. And then remove any taxes you possibly can. And then also give me DSL. And that's going to run you probably under $30 a month.
Or just ask them if they'll give you DSL without a phone line.
They have to give a phone line to DSL because DSL actually rides on a phone line.
You need the copper, but do you need the phone service?
You need a phone number, I believe, to do the routing. Maybe you don't need incoming calls.
From what I've heard, it's more of
a choice,
a policy decision rather than a technical reason. But Rick actually brings up a very good point, which is if you have neighbors in your area that also want internet access, pool it with them. In other words, if you have three houses in a row that all want internet access, have the person in the middle get a connection and then get wireless so that everyone... around there gets it.
Yeah, is that legal? Is that appropriate? I mean, like, let's say I get Cruise.io to give me DSL, right? Mm-hmm. And then my neighbors around me, they don't buy DSL from Cruise.io. And I put up a Wi-Fi spot, and they use my Wi-Fi spot, and we all split the cost of the DSL. That's basically what you're talking about.
How would that be less legal?
They're paying for it.
Yeah, how would that be less legal than, for example, you have a large household that has six people living in it?
Is there any policy in there that says you're not supposed to share between multiple dwellings? And I don't know. I mean, Cruise.io, if I were Cruise.io, I'd want to have a policy like this because it means that I could theoretically saturate that DSL and serve 15 people from it, and they're not making any more money.
Does that mean that anybody with a standalone garage would be liable for it as well?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what the policy is, so it's a little concerning to me. At least.
Right.
We could definitely call up, Mark from Cruise.io and ask him.
Are you saying West Side probably will not get Free Wi-Fi?
The free Wi-Fi thing has been kind of slowed down in Santa Cruz. I haven't heard about it in about 6 months, like any changes have gone on. I don't think you're going to see it happening anytime soon. Like, okay. if free Wi-Fi is coming to Santa Cruz, then I'm either completely in the dark or they're not talking about it. Basically, it's not happening right now. Okay. And maybe somebody will call me up and say, no, it is happening. We're arguing about it right now.
Apparently, Portland has it.
Portland has it. There's a couple other cities in the United States have it. See, the problem with it is that when you change it into a utility, then what happens to the businesses in the area that are doing the utility? They have to be involved. And so now it's a government-sponsored thing. And I don't know. It depends on how you think about politics, whether that should be a governmental issue
right,
or
and
not.
Recall, and just remember also that it's not free Wi-Fi. It's Wi-Fi paid for by local tax dollars.
Right.
So it's always a good thing just to keep in mind.
Okay.
And there is free Wi-Fi in Santa Cruz. Pretty much every coffee shop has it. The library has it.
We have one near us, in fact. And then there's a game store that's getting it free from the coffee shop next door to it.
How close are you to those places?
Pretty close.
So you could actually probably get an antenna.
They close early.
And they shut it down? Because you could probably get an antenna or make an antenna that reaches the signal a little further. You can go miles with Wi-Fi, both directions, by just having a really good directional antenna on your Wi-Fi signal. So you could look into that. It's kind of going to cost you a little bit of money. Like, it even might cost you $300 or $400, which would be months of DSL service. So,
I could set up an antenna that would access, like, the coffee shop?
At least double the range, if not more. Yeah, there's this thing called the Pringles antenna, and basically you take a Pringles can and you make it a shotgun Wi-Fi antenna. And you can get a lot longer distances. And it actually works both directions because your transmission signal goes that far and your receiving signal is also more sensitive to receiving.
Right. With regard to Wi-Fi, there's nothing in it that says that it can only go a certain distance, just that it usually goes a certain distance over air. Right. But the longest distance, I believe, is something on the order of 1,500 miles.
Yeah, we had some crazy...
That we just have people with these large satellite dishes.
That's antennas on both sides.
Satellite dishes on both sides. Pointing toward one another.
And, of course, they actually have to modify the spec, so it's not technically the same spec because that spec very clearly states power levels. So, but in any case, that's okay.
And this has to be set up, like, on your roof?
Oh, delay times. What you want is a direct site, so you don't want a building in the room. But, yeah, you can theoretically do that. What we're talking about here is a very geeky thing, though. Unless you're a geek and you want to spend time doing this, you probably don't want to do this. Because the other thing is, what if all of a sudden they initiate some kind of security on their system?
Yeah, because if too many people start doing it to the coffee shops, they're going to have to lock it down.
And if they're not aware that you're using it in some areas, I'm not even sure if this area, you're actually breaking the law if you use it and you're parked outside their business.
Do they normally shut it down?
No, if I was running Wi-Fi signal, I would never shut it down in the evening because you have to reboot the gear and stuff. Now it doesn't make any sense.
Oh, okay. So it's possible I could just sit in my vehicle out there.
Yeah, but people have been ticketed for doing that kind of thing. So be careful and find out from the police if it's okay.
I really doubt it.
I doubt it too.
They'd think it was high class for this area. Okay.
Thank you so much,
great.
Dave, for the call.
You.
Bye-bye. We're now going to take Chuck from Carmel. Chuck, welcome to Geek Speak. Oh, I'm sorry. We're talking to Ed from Paso Robles. Hi, Ed.
Right. I installed Windows XP over ME on a computer, and all of a sudden I got, when I access the internet, I get a deal saying that there's a security risk that I need to concerned with ME. Should I just forget about it?
What do you mean, concerned with ME?
Well, evidently there's some little tidbits of ME left behind after the installation of XP.
Interesting.
And this caused.
Okay, so when you upgraded to XP, XP has a whole better security model, if you will, especially Service Pack 2, which is probably what you got.
Right.
It enables a firewall, and it enables some more security on your system. Now, by default, when you install Windows XP with Service Pack 2 fresh out of the box, it's going to turn these things on for you. But if you're doing a migration path, they don't want to change your computer experience. So in the migration path, they don't keep them on. Instead, they give you warnings saying, hey, this stuff's not set up to be on. And it's going to keep on giving those warnings until you tell it to never remind you again, or you go ahead and enable those security settings. And the concerns would be is that when you enable the firewall, basically, is what I'm talking about.
Well, it's not just a firewall. Virus XP protection. Will also give you that error with regard to if you have antivirus installed or
if
not.
If you don't, yeah, if you don't have it on, it will give you warnings. Is it saying antivirus? Not sure.
I don't remember. The deal comes up when I access the internet only, and to get through to access the internet beyond the deal, I have to click on the house.
Click on a house.
The home.
The house.
The home the network yeah. thing. Yeah.
The home.
Oh, the home. Okay. You following what's happening here, Miles?
Not really.
I did a stab in the dark on the setting thing.
Yeah. I think we'd have to have a more exact message.
Yeah.
But you should probably start by going into the security center and the control panel.
And following those directions?
Yeah, and turn on all the recommended settings as a start, and that'll at least alleviate some of your errors that you're getting.
What if he goes into the security home center, I guess in system preferences or something? Is that right?
It's right in the control panel, yeah.
And so he goes in the security area.
Yeah.
Is there anything that he can do that will mess up his computer?
Yes. I mean, basically, if you turn the firewall on by default, it's gonna annoy you with pop-up messages. If you have any internet-based services that have outbound connections.
Outside of email and browsing?
Yeah. I mean, outside anything non-standard, like if you have instant messaging clients or things that it doesn't already know about, it's probably going to pop up a window saying, you know, somebody, this application has requested unauthorized access outbound. And you basically just have to say, yes, I know about this.
And there's a checkbox with that says, remember my decision, yeah. right? And you check that and say, yes. So you're basically kind of you're kind of approving everything that happens.
Yeah, and it'll probably be an annoyance. So if you say no to that, not knowing what you're asking, all of a sudden your services will stop communicating with the internet that it triggered that event for.
So take your time when you play with these things. Take your time and read things and understand what's happening. Yeah.
You can always turn it off again, but unfortunately, with the Service Pack 2 and the Security Center, when you turn these things off, unless you sometimes go into the registry settings or make sure you toggle a certain setting, it will constantly annoy you with it, particularly the virus scanner stuff. If you don't have a virus scanner on your system and you turn it off, it will repeatedly bother you about it. There is a
virus. This system has McAfee's.
Oh, good. Antivirus?
Okay. It depends on what version. Some versions of virus scanners Windows won't recognize. Others it will. So it may not recognize. It just depends. That may not be your problem at all. There's also you can select don't monitor this, and it'll stop bugging you about it.
All right, Ed, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Good luck. Well, now let's go ahead and take Chuck from Carmel. He's been waiting patiently. Thank you, Ed, for the call. And Chuck, what's your question today?
Gentlemen, I again want to thank you very much for all your assistance in the world. And I've got a Sony VAIO about 3 or 4 years old. It's got a Pentium M 1.7 gigahertz processor in it.
Uh-huh.
And I've been doing a lot of video recording on DVDs, and it seems like it's very slow. Like it'll take an hour and a half, 2 hours to do a video. I mean, to do a DVD.
Is it taking time to actually burn the DVD or to create the DVD?
To create it.
Prior to burning.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's really two steps there. You've got to encode.
Yeah.
You've got to encode the DVD, and then you burn it. But go on.
Question is could I do any better with some other software? I'm using a GigaPocket, you know, with the one that comes with VAIO.
I'm not real familiar with the different solutions for DVD encryption. MPEG encoding basically is what the speed takes or what's taking so long. But I don't think it's going to matter that much at all. Ryder, would you say?
It's your CPU primarily that's slowing you down.
Yeah,
you need a faster CPU to speed that up.
Now it's possible that if you're talking about the actual burning, then it's a faster burner that you would need.
But no, I think it's preparation.
It's
transcoding from one format to another.
Right.
That's really CPU intensive and memory intensive as well.
Now, it's very possible that you could find a piece of software that would speed it up a little bit, that it's a little more tuned to do DVDs. But because you're actually using the DVD tool set in the VAIO, to try to step out of that and encode with something else,
add some more complications. Like you might have to export it as a AVI file, or you know, a more raw video file, and then transcode it with some kind of command line thing. That would be a little faster, okay. But it's not going to be that much faster.
Mm-hmm. What's
going to be a lot faster for you is go ahead and buy a desktop computer with a high end processor and do all your transcoding on that.
Makes sense. Okay. No. Well, you know, have you got anybody else waiting? I had a couple of questions that came up while
we got about four more people waiting. Yeah, but what's your question?
Okay, well, I'll come back with you later.
No, you're welcome. Guys. Okay, thank you so much for the call.
Bye
bye. Okay, I feel bad. I should have just taken Chuck's call. Oh, well. From Santa Cruz, we have Hal. Welcome, Hal, to Geek Speak.
Hi. We've got a neighborhood T1 line and then a wireless connection from a central point, and it is legal. We each pay a huge amount of money. We're in Cave Gulch. Some people are obviously file sharing, and there are times when the speeds get incredibly slow, even with a
T1.
T1. Are there ways that this could be monitored and or controlled so that somebody couldn't hog bandwidth?
Is your ISP .net or Cruise?
Yeah, it's .net.
I would definitely talk. What does he say?
They're monitoring.
They're monitoring and doing what?
Monitoring.
What do they say then?
Well, this is just really came up over the 4th of July when someone's grandson was playing games and left the machine on. And we got down to speeds as low as single digits. And that was only discovered later.
Okay, so Don Fredrickson's the
owner. Yeah, Don and Harry are the people we're dealing with. But they haven't come up with a fix. They're just monitoring. And I just wondered if you guys had some suggestions that we could pass on to them, because we haven't heard any from them.
There's definitely stuff you can do, but it depends on kind of how your network infrastructure is set up. You know, if you
T1 obviously has to come into a central area and then it branches off from there.
Yeah, do you have like a router that's attached to your Wi-Fi, or does your Wi-Fi act as your router? I mean, what plugs into your T1?
All I know is they bring T1 to one spot. There's a transmitter there, and we all have wireless antennas on our individual
houses.
So
this is one of the services I was talking about, that when you don't have good coverage of DSL and stuff,
exactly.
Got.net does this great thing where they'll actually find. I mean, it only works in certain areas.
Yeah.
So they can restrict. The way they would do this would be IP filtering, I would believe. You could. Everyone gets an IP address, and got.net could restrict the amount of traffic for each IP. But it gets more complicated than that, because when you're actually active and you want something, you're going to saturate. You're going to use that really fast, like everything you can to get your data to you.
Yeah.
And then you're not going to use it for a long time, right?
Right.
So these are things that are kind of spikes. You want those spikes to function.
There's a dynamic algorithm there that could meter it or something, right?
Yeah, but
you want some sort of quality of service.
But once you get into managing the data at that level, like I don't know of any businesses that does this. I mean, everybody basically says you're a part of the network. You have this amount of flow.
How many households are you talking about?
We had 16 connections now. And there are multiple users at some connections.
Sure.
Have you been able to identify what is consuming the bandwidth?
I'm sorry?
Have you been able to identify what kind of traffic is consuming the bandwidth? Is it mostly peer-to-peer traffic, or is it just...
Well, the one subscriber who identified the problem was his grandson was gaming, and they found the machine when they turned it back on a week after he'd left. You know, the game started running again. Mm-hmm. So that was that. But
gaming,
otherwise, there's people, music file sharing.
Just to let you know.
Admitted that.
Right, just to let you know how the gaming is not a bandwidth sucker. It's just very little data is being sent when you're gaming.
There's probably some file sharing.
Probably peer-to-peer file sharing.
Yeah, turning the computer on after a long period of time, I don't know of any games that do that immediately.
It was file sharing.
Yeah, it was peer-to-peer.
All right.
So what I would do is say, Don, I'm starting to become unhappy with the service, and can you produce some kind of monitoring so we know which house is having issue? But basically, if I was in Don's shoes with got.net doing this, I would be very hesitant to try to get involved in the managing of the traffic on the network.
Uh-huh.
I think that it's maybe a monitoring tool for people to kind of get it. But, you know, this could be a situation where people could get frustrated with each other, and that's not what you want.
Well, there's bandwidth shaping utilities out there that you can identify the types of traffic, what protocol they're using, and cap the bandwidth on those particular services and allow other people that are just browsing the internet to have a higher priority for
How many houses are we talking about?
16.
At this point, there could be another five could join.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not, actually, that's not a lot of bandwidth for 1600.
They're going to install another connection.
Let me put it this way. Shaping bandwidth flow and managing of connections and dealing with Wi-Fi and dealing with T1, if I were to call the expert on this stuff that I know, it would be Don. So,
okay.
There you go.
Okay, thanks very much.
You bet. Thanks for the call. We are taking calls and questions of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We're going to go ahead and take Bruce from Aptos. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi, Bruce. What's your question today?
Yeah, I'm just usually not along these lines with you guys, but I want to know about transference of cassettes to hard drives, meaning burning cassettes onto CDs. You know, I have a laptop. I don't have a regular computer, but when I tried it, I went to Radio Shack. They got the hookups. I get an inordinate amount of static. And I'm wondering, somebody said if I went to a regular computer, and procedure-wise, I want to know if you guys could tell me how I could do that burning cassettes onto CDs.
You mean this, like the software or the physical hardware that you...
Yeah. Do you know, is it... you get better reception or better burning quality when you do it on a regular computer as opposed to a laptop?
Where you would be getting the static is from the cassette deck into the computer, into the laptop. And I mean, it seems odd to me that a laptop, any laptop really, wouldn't have the fidelity for a tape.
Well, it's not the fidelity issues. It probably has to do with impedance issues. So a lot of laptops actually don't have the right line level input on their input volume because they're set up for microphones. So are you running a Mac or a PC?
I have a PC.
Okay, so the input on your laptop is probably designed to be the input for a microphone because most people use it as headphones, and you're running a line level that's so much higher than that that you're going to run into clipping issues. So what you have to probably do is turn your volume down way low on your tape deck, and when you turn your volume way down on your tape deck, all the heat-related or thermal-related noise issues that are inside the circuitry are the same level. They haven't decreased. Mm-hmm. And so that's what you're seeing.
What about turning the microphone level down on your control panel?
Same kind of issue. Uh-huh. You really want to do an impedance match, and that has to do with you want to match your levels, basically.
Yeah. So a desktop computer most likely will have a line in.
But I have
a
relatively cheap solution for
you. Or you can get a USB.
Yes. Yeah. There's this great little thing. It's like it's white. It's actually sold for Macintoshes, but it's being used all over the place. It's a USB dongle kind of thing. It's a circle puck. I think it's called the I. Does anyone know what this thing's called?
But yeah, they're really cheap.
And what it is it's designed to rip vinyl and tapes onto your computer, and the line input level is perfect for that. And it comes with software that runs on your computer that actually manage that process for you. Now, I know I've seen this on the Mac. I'm sure they've got the solution, same kind of solution on the Windows machine.
Okay, would I be able to purchase that like Radio Shack or any place?
I would do a Fry's level business, not a Radio Shack, or an online solution, though. Yeah.
So if you're saying that do I have to follow procedure wise of cutting down the volume on both when I do the transference? Right.
Now, chances are, once you have an actual line in, that you should bump up the volume on your tape deck to about as high as you can handle it. So that the signal
is really strong.
Yeah, overrides the noise.
That's right. Now, the second thing about this is that it is nice to have a software package that understands I am pulling songs from a tape, because what it will do is it will look for the silence points, and it will actually cut that into different tracks. And most of these, like, import devices that allow you to do this kind of work, the piece of hardware, comes with a software that does this. But other software solutions, mm-hmm. like Roxio, does this kind of really good.
Nero does it.
Oh, yeah. And so the software package is pretty important. Oh, my goodness. We are running out of time today on GeekSpeak.
Well, I appreciate you guys. Thanks.
Thank you so much for the call. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBH Santa Otto, or on the web at kusp.org.